Good afternoon, Mangino. Thank you very much for tuning in. There's the latest on COVID-19. We just heard news at the top of the hour regarding the Pfizer vaccine for children ages 5 to 11, and it looks as though the efficacy is extremely high. However, there are also concerns regarding the vaccine itself. And the way it's being phrased is that the benefits of the vaccine likely outweigh the risks. And that word likely is one that I think is going to be very concerning to a lot of people. And I wanted to talk about that. And also, the latest from the National Institute of Health, they released papers saying that, yes, they did work with a laboratory in Wuhan. It was about funding some research on viruses, including the coronavirus. But they insist that that research had nothing to do with what we're dealing with now with COVID-19. Helping us make sense of it all is Dr. Amish Adalja. Dr. Adalja, once again, joining us. He's the senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security, a focus on emerging infectious disease, pandemic preparedness, and biosecurity. And you can follow him on Twitter at Amish AA. Dr. Adalja, welcome back to KDK Radio. Thank you for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the benefits and the latest reports out regarding the vaccine for children 5 to 11 from Pfizer, when it comes to the reports regarding the National Institute of Health and this idea that they're admitting that there has been research taking place in Wuhan where COVID-19 is believed to have started one way or the other, what does this admission mean to you? And can you help us better understand what it is that they funded in this research?
Well, they've always been funding coronavirus research in Wuhan. That's never been a secret. The question was whether or not there was funding from the NIH for a certain type of research on coronaviruses called gain-of-function research. And gain-of-function research refers to research in which scientists manipulate a virus, manipulate a pathogen to try and give it new properties, to understand how it would behave with new properties. And that had been something that the NIH has said they weren't funding in Wuhan with the Wuhan Institute of Virology or EcoHealth Alliance. And what's been released is a letter to the House of Representatives saying that there were certain experiments that EcoHealth Alliance performed with NIH funding that had the unexpected result of creating a more dangerous version of a coronavirus, not a coronavirus that's related to or causes pandemic. This is a little bit of a bureaucratic inside baseball fight that's going on regarding definitions of what the NIH was funding, what they weren't funding. But it just is something that becomes more confusing and muddled for the general public to try and understand what was going on in Wuhan in the years and months leading up to the pandemic.
Doctor, help us understand why it's important to do this kind of research in the first place. Is it just because somebody wants to know and it would be great to know, or is there really a benefit in preparing us for a potential future pandemic by doing this research?
My view has always been that gain-of-function research can have promising implications for future pandemic preparedness, because we know that we're going to be faced with many different infectious disease threats. And if you are doing research to understand what it takes for the existing threats, for example, flu viruses or coronaviruses, to gain new properties, you can then track that and say, for example, is this flu virus that's spreading through bird flocks in China, is it developing any worrisome mutations? And the only way that you would know that those were worrisome mutations is because you've studied those mutations. So I think there's great benefit in doing gain-of-function research, but it has to be done transparently and it has to be done safely, because you want to make sure that there's not any kind of biosafety lapse. And this isn't something new that just started with COVID-19. There was a moratorium on NIH funding of gain-of-function research between 2014 and 2017 after some controversial experiments with bird flu. So this is maybe lots of people are just hearing about this for the first time, but this is a really active area of debate in my field for the last almost 10 years or so. But I do think there is value, but it has to be done safely and transparently is the bottom line.
Well, when it comes to being done safely, is there an argument to be made that this is something that should be done within the confines of the United States, or at least to what we would fund would be done here, where we could have much greater oversight of what's being done and how secure those facilities are?
Well, I think it's very hard to do that when you're talking about emerging infectious diseases, because many of these viruses don't exist in the wild in the United States. So if you're going to be interested in some of these high threat pathogens, you're not going to find them in the United States. So not all of that research could be done in the United States. The United States does have partners. And remember, what we're talking about here is not gain-of-function writ large. We're talking about gain-of-function funding from the NIH. And the NIH does fund gain-of-function research. It's just that there had been statements to the effect that they weren't funding gain-of-function research with respect to this particular lab in Wuhan and EcoHealth Alliance. So this is, again, going to get very complicated for anybody that doesn't know the names of all these players and understanding what actually is being disputed. And what really seems to be going on now is more of a bureaucratic issue of whether or not the research fundee actually filed the paperwork on time, why they didn't file things and miss some deadlines. If you really go into the nitty-gritty, it's coming down to something as small as that. But I think that the larger point is that when you do gain a function research, you want to make sure it's being done at high biosafety levels so that there aren't lapses. And gain of function research is done by many countries all around the world, in many countries all around the world. So it's not something that is solely the province of the United States. For example, the Netherlands does gain of function research. They are the ones who had the really controversial flu virus experiment that created a controversy several years ago.
Can this research be used in a military capacity?
Well, all research on biology has dual use purposes. So that's one of the issues when it comes to biological weapons, is that the expertise you have just by being a microbiologist who works on naturally occurring infections also is going to give you certain levels of skills when it comes to military uses of these agents, perhaps for nefarious use. So it's not something that you can really separate, because and that's why it's called dual use research of concern. That's a whole concept that we talk about, that there are legitimate purposes for some of this research, and then there may be nefarious or military purposes for this research. And it's very hard to draw the line, because it's the same type of expertise, the same types of experiments that would be applicable for designing a better vaccine to also designing something that might evade a vaccine. It just depends on the context and the way you look at it.
Dr. David Roman, a Stanford microbiologist, said that this is a sad tale of inadequate oversight, disregard for risk, and insensitivity to the importance of transparency. Your reaction to his comments, and is there anything we can do to improve that oversight, to diminish the risk, and to be more transparent in this research?
Well, again, this is all coming back to NIH governance of the research. And remember, the NIH isn't the only person who funds the only entity that funds research. There are many other entities that fund research. What we're talking about here is that it might have been unclear to the NIH what research was being done with the funds that they were providing. And it's not that the NIH doesn't fund gain-of-function research. It's important to remember that they do this. It's just that's not what was on the grant application. So a lot of this it might sound very esoteric and dull, but what it ends up boiling down to is that when EcoHealth Alliance applied for this grant, they did not say they were going to be doing gain-of-function research, because that creates there's more scrutiny, there's more biosafety that needs to be put into place, and it appears that they were doing something at least on the borderline or on the cusp of gain-of-function research, if not across the line, which is permitted, but it has to be declared. That's the issue with transparency. So again, just going back to what I said earlier, this is a lot of inside baseball that's going to be lost on the general public when you try to actually explain it all, because it's something that's been going on for some time in our field.
When it comes to the vaccine for children from Pfizer-BioNTech, read a story from Bloomberg where the benefits likely outweigh the risks with those who are 5 to 11 years old. For a lot of parents, that's going to be cause for a stop and wait and think, what do you mean likely outweighs the risks? Is there an assessment that needs to be made with this vaccine for parents of children 5 to 11 about whether or not they should be giving this vaccine to their children in the first place?
Well, I think it is important to do a risk-benefit calculation, and you have to remember that scientists speak in words like likely, which doesn't mean that there's any doubt that there really is. It's just saying that when you weigh the benefit of the vaccine against the risks of COVID-19 and the risks of the vaccine comes out on top. And some of that is contingent upon how much spread is going on in the community and how much the other segments of the population are vaccinated. So in a country unlike the United States, where you have a lot of the adults vaccinated, there's less importance in vaccinating children because there's less COVID around. But in the United States, the risk of COVID to a child contracting it, having their life disrupted by it, is very high because we don't have enough of our adults vaccinated. So therefore, we're coming up with a strategy to vaccinate children because they're not spared from getting infected from COVID, even though they may be spared from severe consequences, and it disrupts mm-hmm. them and it disrupts their schooling. And when you look at the vaccine clinical trial, there's not any major side effect that comes out that really puts anybody off on the vaccine when it comes to this 5 to 11 age group. And I think it's also important to think about the fact that children have been kind of put on hold for the whole pandemic, and I think it's mostly not because of what the virus has done to them, but it's what adults have done to them. And this is kind of a societal type of issue that's happened in the United States where it's become a priority to vaccinate children in order to get their lives back. And it's different in other parts of the country. And again, that may have to do with the fact that we have not had very good vaccine uptake. So children remain at risk. And I think that's kind of what's governing what's going to happen with this 5 to 11 age group approval for the vaccine. It's that this is a way to allow children to be children again. And I do think it is a safe and effective vaccine. And the benefit to them from severe disease may be marginal because they're not likely to get severe disease. But the benefit mm-hmm. from not having their life disrupted by COVID is very, very high.
Yeah, my understanding is that the 90% effectiveness is not only about not going to the hospital with severe illness and death. It's about even being able to contract it in the first place. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, that the 90%+ effectiveness is against symptomatic COVID. So this prevents, the vaccine seems to be very robust at preventing them from even having any symptomatic case of COVID. And again, if you can avoid getting COVID, even if it's a mild case, why not avoid it? Because do you want to have a child isolated for 10 days? Do you want contact tracing? Do you want contacts to be quarantined? And in schools and other places, vaccinated children are going to be treated very differently. They may not have to go home and self-quarantine if they're fully vaccinated. So this is a way to really increase the resiliency of your child against COVID-19, even if it's not against severe consequences, which they're not really at risk for, but mm-hmm. for all of the societal implications of a COVID-19 case, plus just feeling miserable for several days and not being able to do anything.
We have talked before about when you look at age demographics from those who were seniors and coming down, clearly the benefit overwhelmingly for the seniors, and younger you get, then the benefit is not as great as it was for the seniors. For children, when you talk about that risk assessment that is made in determining this, what do you mean more specifically about making a risk assessment for a parent in making that determination of getting the vaccine for their child?
I think it's important just to remember there's not a safety signal that we're worried about at all. The question is, you know, do children really benefit from the vaccine? And that's something that is not so much reflective of preventing the child from being hospitalized, because that's an extremely low risk to begin with, which is very different than the older populations. But what the benefit of the vaccine, so what you're weighing is the risk of the vaccine, which I mm-hmm. think is very, very low in general. It's a safe vaccine versus the benefit of the vaccine. And the benefit of the vaccine is more about allowing a child to go about their life undisrupted from COVID-19. And that's that calculation you're making, saying, okay, maybe my child is not at risk for getting severe COVID, so I don't think I need this vaccine. But if they get the vaccine and then there's an exposure at their school, my child doesn't have to go home and quarantine. Or I don't have to worry about my child having to stay home for 10 days or get sick or just feel miserable if they get infected or worry about it at all. because they've taken that threat off the table. So in that sense, I think if you're a parent of a child between the ages of 5 and 11, the vaccine makes a lot of sense because it's going to be something that's a value to your child's life. Even if it's your child isn't at major risk for severe COVID-19, they're definitely at risk from having their activities disrupted from COVID-19 in a country in which we have maybe 56% of the population fully vaccinated.
Dr. Amish Adalja, once again, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins University Center for Health Security, with his focus on emerging infectious disease, pandemic preparedness, and biosecurity. And you can follow him on Twitter at AmishAA. Doctor, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks.